Season 2, Next of Kin, Episode 1. A housekeeper named Maria Gutierrez is 17 minutes from the end of her shift. A retired man is dead in a bathtub 2 doors down. And Detective Grimes is about to walk into a case that will unravel everything she thinks she knows about a family. This is a work of fiction. All characters and events are imagined. Prologue. Maria Gutierrez was 17 minutes from freedom when Gary found her. She'd been stripping linens on the 14th floor, working her way through the last block of checkouts with the mechanical efficiency of a woman who'd cleaned hotel rooms for 11 years. 2 more rooms, and she was done. Her cart was nearly empty of fresh towels, her garbage bags nearly full, and if she hit the service elevator by 3:15, she could make the crosstown bus and be in the bleachers by kickoff. Diego had a game at 4. Her boy, her little striker, had scored twice last week, and she'd only heard about it from the other mothers in the parking lot afterward. She'd missed the last 2 games. She wasn't missing this one. She was in 1408 when she looked at her phone. 3:43, 17 minutes. The room was a standard checkout. Guest had been tidy, which she appreciated more than most people would understand. Sheets pulled back to air, towels in a pile, minibar untouched. 6 minutes, maybe 7. She stripped the bed with the motions she'd performed so many thousand times that her hands had their own memory for it. Corner, corner, lift, roll, into the bag. Fresh fitted sheet, corners tucked the way they'd trained her, though the training had been a long time ago and the corners were now just hers, the way you absorb a skill until it stops belonging to whoever taught it to you. Her cart sat in the hallway. The front left wheel had been squeaking since October, and she kept forgetting to ask maintenance to look at it. She'd been meaning to oil it herself, but the small bottle of WD-40 she'd bought sat in her locker in the break room, not in the pocket of her cart where it belonged. The squeak had become part of the rhythm of the floor, the same as the ice machine at the end of the hall that cycled every 20 minutes, the same as the elevator that hesitated half a second before the doors slid open. You learned the sounds of a building. After 11 years, she knew the 14th floor the way she knew her own apartment. She restocked the bathroom in under 4 minutes. Fresh towels hung at the angle the brand standards specified. Soap unwrapped, toilet paper folded to a point, the small shampoos and conditioners arrayed in their designated order. Though nobody had ever checked in 11 years, she did it the same way every time. 1408 done. She logged it on her phone, stripped her gloves, added them to the bag. The game was at 4. The 38 bus left at 4 from the corner of 5th and Meridian, and if she was on that bus, she'd be at the field by 4:15, which was 15 minutes into the first half, which was not ideal but was not missing it. Not the way she'd missed the last 2. Her phone buzzed. Gary. Hola, Gary. I'm almost done on 14. I have...
English, Maria.
I said I'm almost done on 14. I have... 1412 needs a turn. Guest overstayed, card declined, management authorized entry. She closed her eyes. Gary, I have...
I know you have somewhere to be. You always have somewhere to be.
His voice carried that particular tone, the one that reminded her she'd been written up twice, that her English was a condition of employment he'd mentioned more times than she could count, that the current climate meant people like her needed to work and keep their heads down. He'd never said those exact words. He didn't have to.
Hijo de su,
she muttered, catching herself a syllable too late.
What was that?
Nothing. I said I'm on my way.
That's what I thought. And Maria, Mrs. Claiborne is watching hours this week. You want your last check to be a full one, I'd take care of this and smile about it.
She hung up before she said something that would cost her more than an afternoon. She grabbed her cart and headed for 1412, the wheels squeaking against the hallway carpet like a small, persistent complaint. The Do Not Disturb sign was still hanging from the handle. She knocked anyway, 3 firm raps, the way training required.
Housekeeping!
Silence. She knocked again.
Housekeeping, I'm coming in!
She pressed her master key card to the lock. Green light.
She pushed the door open, bracing herself for the worst. She'd seen everything in 11 years. Rooms that looked like crime scenes. Rooms that smelled like crime scenes. Once, memorably, an actual goat. But 1412 was quiet, almost disappointingly ordinary. The entry was dim, curtains still drawn, and the room had the stale stillness of a space where the air conditioning had been recycling the same breath for days. Something else, too, underneath the staleness, a smell she couldn't quite place, sweet and heavy and wrong. Then she saw the room service tray. It was on the desk, half hidden behind the curtain. A hamburger barely touched, the bun green-gray with mold, the patty shrunken and dark. A handful of fries curled like dead fingers beside a puddle of ketchup that had dried to the color of rust. A glass of something that had once been clear, now cloudy. 2 days, maybe three. Dios mío, she muttered, wrinkling her nose. She grabbed the tray and set it on her cart in the hallway. That was the smell. Had to be. She'd found worse. Once, a guest had left an entire lobster dinner under the bed for a week. This was nothing. She propped the door open to get some air moving and took stock. The bedspread was rumpled, but not destroyed. A suitcase sat open on the luggage rack, clothes scattered around it on the floor as if someone had torn through it in a hurry. Then she saw the mirror. The small entry mirror, the decorative one mounted above the console table, was cracked. Not shattered, but fractured badly, a spiderweb of lines radiating from a central impact point like something, or someone, had been driven into it. A few shards had fallen onto the table and the carpet below. Perfecto, she muttered. This wasn't a quick turn anymore. This was an incident report, a maintenance request, a conversation with Gary where he'd find a way to make it her problem. She pulled on her latex gloves and picked up the loose shards carefully, dropping them into her garbage bag. She'd note the damage on the room report and let the front desk sort out the charges. Not her problem, not today. She turned to the clothes scattered around the suitcase. A pair of khakis crumpled on the floor, a button-down shirt half inside out, a worn leather belt coiled on the carpet like a snake at rest. She picked up the khakis first, folding them loosely, and paused. A small dark spot on the fabric near the pocket, another on the shirt collar. She rubbed the spot between her gloved fingers. Dry, reddish brown, could be coffee, could be wine, could be rust from a leaking pipe. She didn't let herself think about what else it could be. She folded the clothes quickly and placed them back in the suitcase, trying not to look at the other spots she was now noticing. On the suitcase lining, on the sleeve of a jacket she hadn't seen before, small drops that someone might have left while digging through the bag in a hurry. She closed the suitcase lid so she could get to the carpet. The vacuum drowned out the silence, which was a relief. She worked in quick, efficient passes around the bed and the desk, the machine picking up lint and dust and tiny fragments of mirror glass that had scattered further than she'd realized. The comforter had marks on it too, she noticed as she passed. Faint smudges near the edge, as if someone had leaned against the bed or braced themselves on it with dirty hands. She didn't strip it. She should have stripped it. But stripping meant remaking, and remaking meant time, and time meant missing the bus and the game and Diego's face scanning the bleachers for her again. She straightened the bed instead, pulled the comforter tight, tucked the corners, fluffed the pillows. Good enough. She'd gotten good at good enough. The bathroom door was closed. She'd been aware of it since she walked in, the way you're aware of a closet door in a dark room. The smell was stronger near it, that sweet, heavy, wrong smell that she'd told herself was the room service tray. But the tray was in the hallway now, and the smell was still here, thicker, closer, pressing against the closed door like something trying to get out. She pushed the door open. The smell hit her like a wall. Thick, wet, alive in a way that didn't make sense. It crawled into her nose and down her throat and wrapped itself around the part of her brain that handled language and shut it down. Her eyes watered. She pulled her shirt collar over her nose and breathed through the fabric, blinking until the bathroom came into focus. Glass everywhere. The bathroom mirror, larger than the entry mirror, mounted above the sink, was destroyed. Not cracked, destroyed. A hole gaped in its center and fragments covered the counter, the floor, the edge of the bathtub. Dark smears streaked the remaining glass still clinging to the frame, the white tile of the walls, the edge of the counter. More smears on the floor, trailing toward the tub. Not rust, not wine, not anything she could pretend away anymore. Maria's hands were shaking. She should leave. She knew she should leave. But the part of her that had cleaned rooms for 11 years, the part that had survived a border crossing at 19 and a marriage that nearly killed her and a labor dispute that cost her 6 months of wages, that part said, finish the job. Because if she walked out now and called Gary and this turned into something, there would be questions. There would be police. And police meant paperwork, and paperwork meant scrutiny, and scrutiny meant someone looking at her documents, her status, her everything. She was legal. She had her papers. She had every right to be here. But she also knew, the way every Maria in every hotel in every city in this country knew, that legal and safe were not the same thing. She got the broom from her cart, swept the glass into a pile, then into the dustpan, then into the garbage bag with the shards from the entry mirror. She wiped the counter with a damp cloth, working fast, not looking at the smears, not thinking about what was under her gloves. Sprayed the floor with disinfectant. Mopped. The chemical smell of the cleaner fought against the other smell and lost, but it gave her something to focus on. Pine. Ammonia. Things that belonged in a bathroom. The bathtub had the shower curtain pulled closed. White, standard issue, slightly yellowed at the bottom. Maria realized she'd been hearing a sound, a faint, rhythmic drip from behind the curtain, a leaking faucet. Normal. Hotels had leaking faucets. The smell was coming from the tub. She reached for the curtain the way she'd reached for 10,000 shower curtains before, one hand on the edge, pulling it back in a single smooth motion so she could spray the tub and be done and get to the bus and get to the game and watch her son score. She pulled the curtain. The man was in the bathtub. He was on his side, curled slightly, like he'd been trying to make himself smaller. His face was turned toward her, but it wasn't a face anymore. Not really. Swollen and dark and wrong in ways her mind refused to catalog. His shirt was stained so completely that its original color was a guess. One arm was bent beneath him. The other was extended, fingers curled against the porcelain, and she could see the nails, broken, some of them, as if he'd been clawing at something. Or someone. The dripping was the faucet. Just the faucet. But the water in the bottom of the tub wasn't clear. The sound that came out of Maria Gutierrez was not a scream. It was something older than that. A sound from the basement of the human experience, the place where language hasn't been invented yet. It echoed off the tile and filled the room and followed her as she stumbled backward, her shoes slipping on the wet floor, her hip catching the edge of the counter, her gloved hands that had touched everything, grabbing at the doorframe as she fell through it. She crawled more than ran through the hotel room, past the straightened bed and the closed suitcase and the cracked mirror and her cart with soiled towels and tiny shampoo bottles and the squeaking wheel she kept meaning to oil. She made it to the hallway before her legs gave out. She sat on the carpet with her back against the wall and her knees pulled to her chest. Her hands were still gloved. She stared at them. She thought about the spots on the khakis, the smears on the counter, the glass she'd swept into a garbage bag, the carpet she'd vacuumed, the comforter she'd straightened instead of stripped. She thought about police, about questions, about the way certain faces behind certain desks looked at women with her last name, even when the papers were right, even when everything was legal, even when she'd done nothing wrong. She should call Gary. She should call 911. She should do something other than sit on this carpet and shake. She pulled off the gloves. She called Gary. And when he answered with that tone, the one that assumed she was about to be a problem, she said 5 words in perfect English. There's a dead man. 1412. She didn't make Diego's game. Chapter 1. Week 1. What the hell happened? The hotel manager met them in the lobby with the particular expression of a man who'd rehearsed looking concerned without looking liable. His name tag said Raymond, and Raymond wanted Detective Sarah Grimes to know that the Meridian Hotel took guest safety very seriously, that this was an isolated incident, that their cooperation with law enforcement was absolute and immediate, and that perhaps, if it wasn't too much trouble, they could use the service elevator rather than walk past the restaurant with their badges showing. Grimes took the main elevator. 14th floor, Callahan said, pressing the button. Except it's actually 13. They skip it. I know how hotels work, Callahan. Just making conversation. Don't. Room 1412 was already taped off when they arrived, two uniforms standing in the hallway looking the way uniforms always looked at death scenes, somewhere between bored and rattled, depending on how many they'd worked. The Do Not Disturb sign was in an evidence bag, tagged and numbered, sitting on top of the console table just inside the door. The housekeeping cart was still parked against the opposite wall, wheels locked, a roll of garbage bags spilling from its bottom shelf. Grimes pulled on her gloves and ducked under the tape. The smell hit her three steps inside, the layered kind, disinfectant over something that had been sealed in a warm room for days. She'd been doing this long enough that the smell was less an assault and more a notification. Hello, something died here. Figure out who and why and how, and then go home and stand in the shower for 20 minutes and still smell it. The room told a story, but someone had torn out half the pages before she arrived. She stood at the entry and read it left to right the way she always did, before she touched anything, before she talked to anyone. The bed was made, poorly, a hasty job, not hotel standard, the comforter pulled tight with the corners tucked, but the middle slightly bunched, a straightening rather than a remaking. Near the foot, faint smudges. She could see the shape of them from where she stood, a lateral smear and two darker spots where someone had braced, or caught themselves, or leaned. A suitcase sat closed on the floor beside the luggage rack, clothes presumably inside. The entry mirror above the console table was fractured, spiderweb cracks radiating from a central point, the kind of damage that said impact rather than accident, something driven into the glass, the force of something living and unwilling. The carpet had been vacuumed. The machine tracks were still visible, parallel lines in uniform passes, the kind you left when you worked fast and didn't overlap quite enough. She traced them with her eyes. Whatever had been on that carpet, glass, fiber, trace, had been picked up and deposited somewhere in the bag of the housekeeper's machine. She turned to the uniform at the door. Who cleaned this room before calling it in? He checked his notes. Housekeeper, Maria Gutierrez. She's downstairs with a translator and a union rep. Front desk says she was assigned the room after the guest's card declined. Cleaned the main area and part of the bathroom before she found the body. Grimes stood very still for a moment. She cleaned the room. Yes, ma'am. Before finding the body. The body was in the bathroom, behind the shower curtain. She worked front to back. Grimes closed her eyes and counted to three. The technique came from her mother, not from any department training, and it worked about as well now as it had when she was 16. Callahan. Yeah? Our crime scene has been vacuumed, mopped, and tidied. The carpet's been run over, the mirror glass has been swept into a garbage bag, whatever was on those clothes has been folded back into the suitcase, and the comforter with what I'm guessing are blood smears has been straightened like we're expecting the next guest. She kept her voice flat, factual. There was nothing to be done about it now except work around it. We need that cart, the vacuum bag, every garbage bag she used today, and her gloves. Before this hotel dumps any of it. Their waste cycle. When does housekeeping clear the floor carts? The uniform looked uncertain. Grimes looked at him until he went to find out. On it, Callahan said, already moving. And Callahan, he stopped. Find the housekeeping card on 14, he went. She heard him accelerating in the hallway. She turned back to the room and kept working. The desk, room service tray gone, she could see the ring it had left on the surface. She noted it. The nightstand, a single room key card in the slot beside the lamp, no second card, no personal effects beyond a set of reading glasses folded neatly beside the clock. The closet, empty bar the room's complimentary bathrobe, hangers pushed to one side. Everything a man had brought with him for one night was in that suitcase, and someone had gone through the suitcase. She could tell from the way the clothes were packed, the compression wrong for someone who'd taken anything out, right for someone who'd searched and replaced in a hurry. The suitcase had been searched after. She went to it, crouched, unzipped it without moving it from the floor. The clothes were folded, but folded by different hands at different times. Some items neatly quartered the way a careful person packed, others bunched and restuffed. A button-down shirt near the top had small dried spots on the collar. She looked without touching. The suitcase lining had more, darker drops, spaced irregularly, not spray pattern, more like drip or transfer. Someone with blood on their hands had reached into this bag. Two sets of hands touched this suitcase, she noted, one before the violence, one after. She stood and looked at the door. Entry mirror, impact point at head height, maybe an inch lower. Someone's head or someone's fist or someone's shoulder. The fight had started the moment the door closed, maybe before. The bathroom door was open. Callahan had gone in first while she was in the lobby with Raymond. She walked to the doorway and looked. It was bad. Callahan had a gift for understatement. The mirror above the sink was not cracked. It was gone. A hole in the center, a violence of it, the remaining glass clinging to the frame in jagged points, each shard streaked dark. The counter bore smears and a scatter of dried drops. The floor showed more, a trail that led from the counter area to the tub, the language of it a kind of terrible grammar she'd learned to read years ago. The shower curtain was pulled back, and the man in the tub looked like something that had been left in weather. She studied him from the doorway. Position, on his side, semi-fetal, one arm trapped beneath his body, the other extended with fingers curled against the porcelain. She could see the broken nails from where she stood. He'd clawed at whoever did this. That was good. That meant trace, skin cells, blood under what remained of the nails, even with the scene compromised. The tub is the least contaminated part, she noted. She found the body before she could finish. Who is he? She said without turning. Callahan had come back in. She could hear him behind her. Thomas Brannick. Rooms registered to him. Credit card, Pennsylvania driver's license. Checked in 3 days ago for a one-night stay. Never checked out. Card declined yesterday when additional charges posted. 3 days ago, one-night stay. He was meeting someone. He was meeting someone who didn't register. No second name on the room, no request for an extra key? Nothing. Walked in, did this, walked out. Front desk has no record of a visitor going up. Hallway camera on 14 is angled too far left, catches the elevator bank but not the full corridor. We have a partial, nothing useful. Grimes processed this. A man books a hotel room for one night, orders food but never eats, is beaten to death in the bathroom within hours of checking in. His visitor arrives without registering and leaves without notice, and the cameras give them nothing. Phone? Not on the body, not in the room. Nightstand, desk drawers, suitcase, bathroom, nowhere. If he had a phone when he checked in, someone took it when they left. She held on to that. Missing phone. She'd need his carrier records, call history, anything that said who he'd been in contact with and when. She'd submit the request this afternoon, but that would take days, maybe a week. For now, the phone was taken, by someone who had a reason to take it. Anything from the room service slip? Hamburger, fries, a Coke, ordered about 40 minutes after check-in. Tray was on the desk, mold on the bun, fries had gone over. Callahan paused. He never ate it. He was dead before it got cold or close to it. She turned. What else do we know about Thomas Brannick? Callahan had his notepad out. Retired police officer, Dunmore, Pennsylvania, small town department about 2 hours northeast. 28 years on the force. Wife Claire, recently deceased. One son, Nathan, early 20s, lives here in the city. Grimes felt the room shift. Not physically. The walls didn't move, the air didn't change, but the weight changed. A retired cop was a different kind of victim, different pressure, different attention, different gravity pulling the case in directions that had nothing to do with evidence. She turned back to the bathroom, back to the man curled in the tub. Callahan? Yeah? Before anyone else gets here, before the delegation shows up from whatever department he worked for, because they will show up, they always do, I want to be clear about something. Thomas Brannick is a dead man in a bathtub. He is not one of ours. He is not Blue. He's a victim, and we owe him what we owe every victim, which is the truth, followed by the work that gets us there. When his colleagues come in here with their feelings and their theories and the name of his son already in their mouths, I need you to stay on this side of the line. You understand me? A beat. Understood. Your father was the same breed. You know what that room looks like from the inside. Don't let them use that. Callahan's jaw tightened. She watched him file it somewhere. Understood, he said again, differently. She turned back to the tub. Why were you here, Tom? The room didn't answer. It never did. But Grimes had learned to hear the shape of what wasn't said, and this silence had a shape she didn't like. The crime was ugly, close quarters, sustained, the kind of rage that keeps going past what death requires. But the setup was something else. One night stay, no second guest, missing phone. A man who drove 2 hours to meet someone and died before his hamburger got cold. Somebody was expected. Somebody came. Somebody left. And so far, they were nothing but a hole in the evidence. They arrived on the second day, three of them in a department SUV that had seen better decades. Sergeant Pete Garza, Officer Danny Wheeler, and a retired lieutenant named Hank Molina, who'd apparently appointed himself spokesman for the dead. Grimes met them in the precinct lobby. Callahan stood slightly behind her, which already told her something. Detectives? Garza spoke first, extending a hand, compact, hard-looking, with the kind of face that had been old since 30. Pete Garza, Dunmore PD. Tom was my sergeant for 12 years. I'm sorry for your loss, Grimes said. She always meant it. You could mean I'm sorry and still mean this is my case at the same time. The two things didn't cancel each other out. We want to know what happened, Molina said. He hadn't offered his hand. Retired, but still carrying it in his posture. The kind of cop who'd never really clocked out. Tom Brannick was a good man, a good officer. 28 years, not a complaint against him. I understand that. Do you? Because what I'm hearing is that his son was arrested the same night, drunk, in this city, and nobody's put those together yet. Grimes felt Callahan shift behind her. She didn't turn. Lieutenant Molina, everything is a connection until it isn't. We're aware of Nathan Brannick. We're aware of the arrest. We follow evidence in the order evidence dictates, not in the order grief suggests. Molina's mouth thinned. Garza put a hand on the older man's arm. We're not here to tell you how to work, Detective, Garza said. We're here because one of ours got killed in your city, and we want to make sure it doesn't go sideways. One of ours. She heard it, filed it. In her peripheral vision, Callahan nodded, a small, involuntary thing, barely a movement. She'd deal with that later. It won't go sideways, I can promise you that. What I need from you is anything that helps. Tom's recent behavior, changes you noticed, his state of mind after his wife died, anyone he mentioned meeting. They talked for an hour. They were given coffee and a conference room. Grimes let them sit down before she sat, which cost her nothing and bought her something she couldn't yet name. Tom had been different since Claire died, quieter, preoccupied. He'd come by the station a few times after the funeral. Not unusual for retired guys, Garza said. They missed the noise, it happened. But he'd been going to the records room, pulling old case files, boxes that hadn't been touched in years. We figured cold case, Garza said. Retired guys latch onto something unfinished after a loss. Gives them a reason to get out of bed. Tom never said what he was looking for. We didn't push. You don't push a man who just buried his wife. He was driving to the city, Wheeler added. The youngest of the three, barely 30, with the earnest intensity of someone who'd idolized the man. Two, maybe three times in the last few weeks. Always alone. Always without saying why. We figured he was seeing Nate, maybe, or following up on whatever he was chasing in those files. Any names? Case numbers? Anything he said? Garza shook his head. Tom was private. Always had been, but after Claire it got worse. He'd call you back when he felt like it. Sit with the files a few hours, leave without saying goodbye. One time I asked him straight out, Tom, what are you working? And he just said, something Claire left me. I figured he meant paperwork, estate business. Garza looked at his hands. I didn't press. Something Claire left me. Grimes wrote it down and underlined it twice. After the delegation left, after Callahan walked them to the lobby and stood there 15 minutes longer than necessary, absorbed in whatever communion passed between people who shared a language she didn't speak, he came back to the bullpen and she was waiting. One of ours, she said. He stopped. What? When Garza said it, you nodded. Don't do that again. You were being recruited. There's a difference. She kept her voice level. Tom Brannick is the victim. He's not one of ours. He's not one of theirs. He doesn't have a team. Dead men don't have teams. The minute you pick a team, you stop seeing what's in front of you and start seeing what you expect to see. I won't have it on this case. Callahan's face went through several expressions before settling on the one he'd learned to use when she was right, and he didn't want to admit it. Understood. Good. She sat at her desk and looked at what she had. A retired cop drives to the city, books a room for one night, orders a hamburger he never eats, is beaten to death by someone who walked in and out like a ghost. His phone is missing. She'd submitted the records request, but it would take days. His colleagues say he'd been chasing something since his wife died, pulling old case files, driving to the city without explanation. Something Claire left me. Nobody knows what. The son was drunk that night. The son was arrested. The small-town cops were already pointing. She had a contaminated scene, a missing phone, and a phrase she'd underlined twice. The phone records would tell her who Tom had been calling. The old case files, if she could get a look at what he'd been pulling in Dunmore, might tell her what he'd been chasing. And whatever Claire had left him might be the thread that connected both. The answer wasn't in that hotel room. Maria Gutierrez had cleaned it away. What was left was in whatever had brought Tom Brannick 3 hours into a city he had no reason to visit, to a hotel room he'd booked for one night, to meet someone who'd left without his phone. The apartment smelled like Claire.
Not really.
She'd never lived there, had only visited twice, both times commenting on the water pressure and the distance from the nearest grocery store with the particular critical affection of a woman who believed her son could do better. But something about the stillness reminded Nate of the house in Dunmore after the hospital bed was removed. The way a space holds the shape of the person who's gone, the way the air takes days to forget. He'd been on the couch for most of 10 days, not consecutively, but in accumulation. Sleeping there, eating there, watching the ceiling fan turn slow as a thought he couldn't finish. The bed was technically fine, but the bed had been where he slept when things were normal, and things were not normal, and he was finding that ordinary objects expected ordinary states of mind from you and punished you for falling short. The couch didn't expect anything. The dishes had become a project he kept meaning to start. The two garbage bags near the door had been tied and ready for the dumpster for 4 days, waiting for the moment he had enough forward motion to carry them. The blinds let in the particular slanted light of late afternoon, which meant it was after 4, which meant he'd lost another day to the specific activity of lying here and failing to think about Claire without thinking about Claire. His phone had 3 unread texts from a college friend he hadn't seen since the funeral. He hadn't answered them. Not because he didn't want to, he did, abstractly, but because answering required using words, and words required decisions about what to say, and every decision lately felt like something he might not survive getting wrong. His phone rang. Dad. He almost didn't answer. They'd been fighting, not the explosive kind, not shouting, but the worse kind. the slow, calcifying silence of two people who couldn't say what they needed to say. Since Claire died, Tom had become a stranger. Not openly hostile, not cold, just absent in the way that's harder to address than absence. Preoccupied, making phone calls from the other room, spending hours on Claire's old laptop, the battered one she'd kept for years with the sticky hinge that she'd always meant to have fixed. Driving to the city for reasons he wouldn't explain. Nate had asked. Nate had pushed. Tom had deflected with the blunt efficiency of a man who'd spent 30 years ending conversations he didn't want to have. He answered. Hey, Dad. Nate. Tom's voice was strange, tight, the way it got when he was saying something he'd rehearsed. I'm coming into town, tomorrow. I'll let you know when I'm settled, we can have dinner. You're coming here? That's what I said. Why? Silence, the kind with a wall behind it. There's something I need to take care of. I'll call you when I'm checked in. We'll grab dinner, somewhere nice. My treat. Somewhere nice. Tom Brannick's idea of somewhere nice was the diner on Route 6, where the coffee came in mugs the size of soup bowls. Tom didn't come to the city. Tom didn't say, my treat, without a reason underneath it. Tom didn't make promises he hadn't already made contingency plans for. Dad, what's going on? You've been... I'll call you tomorrow, Nate. Click. Nate stared at the phone. Something was wrong. Something had been wrong since before Claire died, maybe, if he was honest with himself about the timeline. Since the diagnosis, since the hospice weeks, since those last few days when Claire would hold Tom's hand and whisper things Nate couldn't hear, and Tom would leave the room looking like he'd been hollowed out with a spoon and put back together slightly wrong. He threw the phone at the couch. It bounced off a takeout container and landed face down on a cushion, and the smallness of the gesture, the impotence of throwing a phone at furniture, made him angrier than the call itself. He thought about the bottle of Jameson on top of the refrigerator. The bottle won because it was closer, and it didn't hang up mid-sentence. He drank. Not the cinematic kind, no glass held up to examine, no reflection to stare into, just the steady mechanical kind. Pour. Sip. Pour. The city got dark outside the windows he hadn't opened in a week, and the bottle got lighter, and the phone sat on the couch cushion and didn't ring. Tom was supposed to call when he was settled. Tom didn't call. Nate told himself it was grief. Claire's death had broken something in Tom that couldn't be set right the way some fractures are too close to the joint. He almost believed it. Then the text came, from Tom's number. Two words. At Meridian. Nate stared at it. No room number, no come on over or ready when you are or anything that suggested this was an invitation. Just the name of a hotel, dropped into the conversation like a pin on a map. As if Tom had decided to tell him exactly enough and not one syllable more, because that was apparently who his father was now. A man who communicated in fragments and expected Nate to assemble them into something that made sense. The Jameson said go. The anger said go. The small, desperate part of him that still wanted his father to sit him down and say, here's what's happening, here's why I've been a stranger. That part said go too. He called a cab. He was drunk enough that the city outside the cab window blurred at the edges, drunk enough that his thoughts moved faster than his ability to organize them. The cab took him across town in 12 minutes and deposited him on the sidewalk in front of the Meridian Hotel. Nate stood there and looked up at the building. The lobby was lit and warm through the glass doors. A doorman stood at the entrance with his hands folded, the studied blankness of a man whose job was to see without appearing to. Nate was aware of being seen. He was aware of what he looked like, unshaved, jacket creased from the couch, the specific dishevelment of a person who'd been spending days inside their own grief and hadn't fully accounted for the outside world having witnesses. He didn't go in. He stood on the sidewalk for 5 minutes, maybe 10, long enough for the cold to cut through the Jameson's warmth, long enough for the doorman to look at him twice. He thought about taking the elevator up and knocking on whatever door his father was behind and demanding an explanation for every week of silence and every deflected call and every hour Tom had spent hunched over Claire's laptop instead of picking up the phone. And he knew himself well enough to know what would happen if he did that. Not violence. He wasn't thinking about violence, didn't think about violence. That wasn't the danger. The danger was the other kind of irreversible. The words that came out of a mouth that was drunk and angry and scared and grieving, the words that couldn't be taken back. He'd said things like that before and lived with what they cost. He turned and walked south. 3 blocks to a place called the Lamplighter, a narrow bar with bad lighting and a bartender who didn't ask questions. Nate sat at the end and paid cash and had 2 drinks and stared at his phone, and the phone didn't do anything. Then he walked to McCaffrey's on the corner, familiar territory, which was the wrong reason to go, but he went. 4 beers and a shot. The bartender would tell police later that he'd been quiet, not belligerent, staring at his phone like he was waiting for it to ring. He was sitting on the curb outside McCaffrey's at 1 in the morning when the officer told him to stand up, and he said his mother was dead and his father was a ghost, and they booked him at the precinct. Mugshot, fingerprints, the indignity of minor consequences grinding through a man who was too sad to care. They released him at 7 in the morning. He walked back to the apartment, drank 2 glasses of water, fell asleep on the couch with his shoes on. Tom still hadn't called. By afternoon, the annoyance had shifted into something harder to name. Tom was a lot of things, but he wasn't careless. If he said he'd call, he called. If he didn't call, it was because he'd decided not to, and Tom's decisions were deliberate the way all of Tom's decisions were deliberate. The man made lists, kept notes, drove at 4 miles over the speed limit because going faster didn't save enough time to be worth the risk. Unless he couldn't call. Nate sat with that for a while. The dishes waited. The garbage bags waited. He got up, went to the window. The city was gray and ordinary in the November light, entirely indifferent to the specific quality of wrongness he was feeling. He picked up the phone and called Tom's number, and it went straight to voicemail. No rings, phone off or dead. Tom had never let it die before. Nightstand charger every night, that was Tom. But things had been slipping since Claire, and maybe this was one of the things that had slipped. Nate got his keys. He didn't have a plan beyond the obvious one. North on the highway, Dunmore in 2 hours, Tom's house with the flag bracket and the mowed lawn and the kitchen that still smelled like Claire's cooking even though Claire hadn't cooked in months. He'd stand on the porch. He'd knock. If Tom was there, they'd have whatever conversation Tom had been avoiding for 6 weeks. If Tom wasn't there, if Tom was still in the city, if the hotel stay had extended, if something had happened and Tom needed help, he'd figure that out from there. He drove with the particular focus of a man concentrating on the road so he didn't have to concentrate on anything else. The highway unreeled in front of him, gray asphalt under a gray November sky, and the trees closed in on either side as the city fell away behind him. He didn't turn on the radio. The silence was better, not comfortable, but at least honest. Tom had never not called when he said he'd call. Not once. Not in 23 years. Nate's hands were steady on the wheel, and the phone was dark and silent on the passenger seat, and the silence that had been annoying had become something else entirely. Something he didn't have a name for yet. Something that lived in the chest and pressed outward and wouldn't go away no matter how fast he drove. He drove north.